This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Some nursing home operators are calling for a royal commission into the handling of the COVID pandemic. Staff are exhausted and thousands of residents locked down due to exposures and outbreaks, not to mention the shortage of rapid tests and protective equipment. Some workers are quitting and the federal government's announcing bonus payments in an effort to reward and retain them, and we'll hear about that soon. But as any guest reports, operators say an inquiry is needed to examine all government's decisions to avoid repeating the same mistakes.
Mark Zengraf runs a Melbourne nursing home, which has so far avoided COVID outbreaks.
We have been RAT testing all of our staff, family members and contractors for the past several months, and that's allowed us to ensure that families can come in and visit their loved ones during this period of time.
But he says all facilities should have been supplied with sufficient tests to help avoid the prolonged isolation of elderly people.
It makes me very sad. It's difficult to reconcile that we're in this space.
The chief executive of Samarinda Ashburton Aged Services wants a high-level examination of multiple government's decisions that led to the slow rollout of rapid tests, PPE and vaccines. And he says the best way to do that would be through a royal commission.
A review does need to happen afterwards. I think it needs one which is broad-reaching and has the powers to compel anyone really to come and provide information and advice.
The last Royal Commission into aged care recommended better pay and career pathways to improve nursing home staffing.
More money and more effort needs to be put into this.
His colleague, voluntary board member, Dr. Liz McNaughton, is a Melbourne GP who looks after a lot of elderly people.
I visit 11 different nursing homes in my area. There are about 40 residents in total. And look, I have to say the greater majority have done a marvellous job.
But she's also disappointed by the handling of the pandemic.
I feel very strongly that there needs to be a review and probably a royal commission.
She believes some of the resident isolation and problems with the rollout of vaccines, PPE and COVID tests were avoidable.
There was so much that we could have learned even just from observing what was happening in the Northern Hemisphere. We were way behind, at least 12 months behind, when it came to RAT testing.
Dr. McNaughton's mum moved into care 2 months ago and the shift has mostly been smooth. But the mid-pandemic timing hasn't been ideal.
It's been very frustrating and also worrying that she's had to be on her own, isolated in a room.
Dr. McNaughton says many elderly manage isolation okay, but some of her patients suffer badly.
I've seen people who have become quite depressed and have actually really become almost, once the lockdown finishes, they find it difficult to leave their rooms and to return to their former level of participation.
A spokesperson for the Prime Minister referred AM to Scott Morrison's previous comments that he's focused on the pandemic and there'll be a time to discuss reviews in future.
Any guest reporting there, $800 bonuses are being offered to aged care staff across the country to help retain workers as they struggle through exhaustion to care for residents during the Omicron wave. The Prime Minister will announce that new policy today. The first payment of $400 will come this month. The second $400 payment will come in May when the election's due. Scott Morrison will unveil it during a major speech today aimed at resetting his government, but already the payment's been dismissed as trinkets when diamonds are required. Tom Lowry has this report from Parliament House.
It's been a difficult few months for many in aged care, and some staff are walking out.
We've had a lot leave, I would say 6 to 8 in the last month.
Fiona is an aged care nurse working in northern New South Wales and a member of the Health Services Union.
People have left because they are tired, not because they are retiring, it's because they've had enough.
It's the last thing her aged care home needs. It's currently in lockdown due to a COVID outbreak and residents are anxious and stressed. Fiona says staffing shortages make everything more difficult. And what's worse is this could have been planned for.
COVID wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when. When it did hit, we didn't have the staff ready to cover shifts.
The Prime Minister will today use a speech to the National Press Club to thank aged care workers for their long hours and hard work. and is coming with cash, two one-off payments of $400 for aged care workers across the country, the first this month and the next in May. They're incentive payments aimed at keeping staff in the workforce. The total amount paid will depend on hours worked, and it includes workers in government-subsidised home care and residential care.
This is a period where aged care workers need diamonds and trinkets won't do what's required.
Gerard Hayes is the National President of the Health Services Union.
There's a workforce crisis in aged care, and giving convenient $400 payments prior to an election is just insulting to aged care people.
Last month, both unions and industry groups together called for urgent government interventions to address a crisis in aged care and help retain staff. Direct payments to staff were one suggestion, along with deploying the military into aged care homes and shoring up supplies of rapid tests and PPE. Sean Rooney from Leading Age Services Australia says watching staff leave is an enormous concern.
What we have seen is long-standing reports really over the last 12 months or so of workers leaving because they do feel that they are overworked and undervalued.
He says the structural problem in aged care has already been made clear.
We know that the Royal Commission called out that there is a fundamental disconnect between the value of the work people in aged care do and what they're currently remunerated.
Fiona says she's staying in the sector, upskilling to try and make her work more valuable. But she worries for the future, including her own needs down the track.
If I had to put a loved one in aged care, I wouldn't do it.
Aged care nurse Fiona, ending that report by Tom Lowry at Parliament House. A report into several lockdown parties at Downing Street and the British Cabinet Office concludes there were serious failures of leadership and judgment. The release of an abridged version of the review has prompted fresh calls for the British Prime Minister's resignation. But Boris Johnson's hanging tough, insisting he's not broken the law or lied, but he has said sorry. Europe correspondent Isabella Higgins reports.
After weeks of criticism and calls to stand down over a number of alleged lockdown parties, Boris Johnson arrived in the House of Commons for the judgment day he set up for himself. The Prime Minister has deflected and dodged questions about these events by asking his Westminster peers to wait for the outcome of an internal probe. Now the interim findings of Sue Gray's report are public and Boris Johnson has conceded his office made mistakes.
Firstly, I want to say sorry. And I'm sorry for the things we simply didn't get right, and also sorry for the way that this matter has been handled.
The inquiry looked at 16 events that took place not just in No. 10 but also in Whitehall across 20 months. It found that there were failures of leadership and judgment, that several events shouldn't have taken place, and that there was a culture of excessive alcohol consumption. The leader of the Conservatives told Parliament he will overhaul his office.
I get it and I will fix it. And I want to say to the people of this country, I know what the issue is. Yes. It's whether this government can be trusted to deliver. And I say, Mr. Speaker, yes, we can.
Eight of the events are now also being investigated by the Metropolitan Police for potential breaches of COVID-19 rules. Mr. Johnson has previously apologised for one garden party, denied others happened, but always maintained no rules were broken. Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer says Mr. Johnson should stand down.
The Prime Minister took us all for fools. He held people sacrificing contempt. He showed himself unfit for office. It's everybody's fault but his. They go, he stays.
In the House of Commons, many MPs expressed their frustration and disappointment. Some recounted stories of farewelling dying loved ones through a window during the pandemic. Former Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May says the behaviour inside No. 10 was not good enough.
So either my right honourable friend had not read the rules, or didn't understand what they meant, and others around him, or they didn't think the rules applied to No. 10. Which was it?
It appears Boris Johnson's apology and vow for change have not convinced some in his own party. He is meeting with MPs to try and shore up support. For now, his leadership is hanging in the balance. This is Isabella Higgins in London, reporting for AM.
The United States and Russia have faced off in the United Nations Security Council over concerns about a potential invasion of Ukraine. Russia denies it's planning an attack, accusing the West of whipping up hysteria and trying to provoke conflict. It comes as both the US and the UK continue to warn of unprecedented consequences if Russia invades. North America correspondent Jade McMillan reports.
The 8,960th meeting of the Security Council is called to order.
The United States requested the Security Council meeting, arguing Russia needed to explain the build-up of tens of thousands of troops near the Ukrainian border. Russia tried to keep the session behind closed doors, but was outnumbered, paving the way for a diplomatic brawl in public.
The situation we're facing in Europe is urgent and dangerous. And the stakes for Ukraine and for every UN member state could not be higher.
America's ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, described Russia's mobilization of troops as the largest in Europe in decades, warning the US had evidence that the number of Russian soldiers being stationed in Belarus, just hours away from Ukraine's capital, Kiev, would rise to more than 30,000 by early February.
If Russia further invades Ukraine, none of us will be able to say we didn't see it coming. And the consequences will be horrific, which is why this meeting is so important today.
Russia continues to deny that it's planning an invasion. Speaking through an interpreter, its ambassador to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, instead hit out at the rhetoric of the US.
Western colleagues are talking about the need for de-escalation. However, first and foremost, they themselves are whipping up tensions and rhetoric and are provoking escalation. The discussions about a threat of war is provocative in and of itself. You are almost calling for this. You want it to happen. You're waiting for it to happen as if you want to make your words become a reality.
Russia's statements failed to satisfy Ukraine, with its ambassador, Sergei Kislytsa, telling the meeting his country won't bow to Russian pressure and is ready to defend itself.
We still lack credible explanations by Russia of its actions and military movements. Based on experience, we cannot believe Russian declarations, but only practical moves on withdrawal of troops from the border.
Western allies insist they're still trying to find a diplomatic path forward. The UK has revealed its package of sanctions against Russia will be ready within weeks, including the power to freeze the assets of individuals connected to the government and prevent them from entering Britain. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is expected to hold further talks with Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov tomorrow. If past meetings are anything to go by, though, the chance of a breakthrough appears slim. This is Jade McMillan in Washington, reporting for AM.
A year ago today, Myanmar's military mounted an audacious pre-dawn coup and arrested popular leader Aung San Suu Kyi. In the 12 months since, hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced or fled, while those who've stayed are watching their country fall apart. Southeast Asia correspondent Mazoe Ford reports.
As anti-coup rallies swept across Myanmar after the military takeover, Suu Kyi Kyin, an activist with close ties to deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi, joined in without hesitation. But as security forces began violently cracking down on dissent, the 28-year-old knew she had to flee.
First, I'm not safe. When the second one is that I don't feel I can live fully as a human in this place to achieve my dreams.
She escaped to Thailand and has been granted asylum in a third country, which she doesn't want to name in case it affects her chances of staying there. But as she zips up her suitcase ahead of her flight, there are mixed emotions. Relief to resettle, but also sadness that she can't go home.
I'm leaving the place that I belong. My friends, my family. I don't want to leave that, but I have to survive.
Since the coup a year ago today, security forces have killed 1,500 people. Almost 9,000 have been arrested, including Australian economic adviser Sean Turnell, who's currently on trial in a closed court for allegedly violating the State Secrets Act. It's been a tough year right across Myanmar. 400,000 people have been displaced, the economy and the health system are crumbling, and the UN fears a civil war is brewing as the People's Defence Force grows. Mother of two, Daw Tin Chi, was a senior civil servant, but has been on strike since the coup as part of the civil disobedience movement. I don't have any income. When I ran out of money, I sold all my jewellery to help my family survive. Junta leader Min Online justifies his power grab by saying the last election was fraudulent and argues the crackdown since the coup has been to fight terrorists. He's pledged to hold fresh elections next year, but no one expects them to be free or fair.
The man lacks credibility and simply cannot be trusted.
Nicholas Koppel was the Australian ambassador to Myanmar from 2015 to 2018.
He'll either change the voting system so that it prefers his party, the military party, more than the National League for Democracy. And he's also hobbling many members of the National League for Democracy who remain under arrest, including, of course, Aung San Suu Kyi.
In the meantime, the people continue to strike and protest, and they say they won't give up until the military dictatorship is brought down. This is Mazoe Ford in Bangkok, reporting 4AM.
Just a footnote to that, the names of the two women in from Myanmar and Mazoe's report have been changed for their safety. Beijing residents are largely welcoming the Winter Olympics this week, despite COVID measures shutting them out of the Games and controversy abroad about China's human rights record and Australia's diplomatic boycott. Our China correspondent Bill Birtles reports.
At a Beijing ice skating park, 63-year-old Zheng Jianguo is teaching his 3-year-old granddaughter to skate. I like ice skating, she says. And her grandfather says he's planning to watch the sport at the Olympics.
I'm very happy to welcome friends from all over the world to know about the Chinese people. Whether it's Winter or Summer Olympics, it's sport and we love it.
Mr. Zheng will have to watch the skating on TV as thousands of athletes and team members arrive in Beijing ahead of Friday's opening ceremony. They're entering a forbidden city within the Chinese capital. Hotels that are fenced off and guarded, buses that shuttle the foreigners straight to the Olympic venues. 19-year-old student Wang Man says the measures make her feel safe.
I think the pandemic is a global issue that no one can avoid, but China has worked very hard to control the virus spread and to host a very safe Olympic Games.
Ms. Wang was in primary school the last time Beijing held an Olympics in the northern summer of 2008. And Australia's decision, along with several Western allies, to diplomatically boycott the Games over multiple human rights concerns isn't on the 19-year-old's mind.
I think China's relations with other countries now compared to 2008 are generally much better. Our country has developed and now we can help many other countries.
Chinese officials have said 2008 introduced modern China to the world, whereas this year is about showcasing China's global achievements. The economy is more than three times bigger than it was in 2008. Chinese tourists surged threefold in the decade after the Games and became the biggest overseas group to visit Australia and many other countries. But COVID has shut China's borders and stopped the flow of tourists and students. International sites like Google and Facebook that could be accessed in 2008 have all been blocked, and the government is fanning an increasingly triumphant form of nationalism through education and the media. Independent Beijing commentator Wu Qiang says the Winter Games are taking place at an extraordinary time.
In the past decade, China's politics has completely changed. It's hard for the international community to imagine, even though they've seen China's more aggressive posture. China is now in unprecedented isolation before the Winter Olympics, and the nationalism inside China is becoming stronger and stronger.
Back at the ice skating park, people all agree one change has definitely affected them. That China hosting the Winter Games encouraged them to take to the ice.
China correspondent Bill Birtles, and that's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the new podcast ABC News Daily. Thousands of US hospitals are on the brink of collapse, with record COVID-19 admissions and more than 2,000 people dying each day. Today on the podcast, we hear from two doctors from opposite sides of America on what it's like to be inside the ER. Look for ABC News Daily on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.